Hello, I'm John Charles, and welcome to another virtual author chat with the Poison Pen Bookstore. Today, the Poison Pen is honored to have with us author Roger Lynn Howell, whose new book is Always Something Sings. Before we begin, for those listening in, the Poison Pen does have copies of Always Something Sings, and we would be happy to hold one for you or put one in the mail. Just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen Bookstore. Now, I'd like to welcome Roger.
Hi, it's good to be here, and I really appreciate it. I love these chats when I'm watching it, and it's kind of exciting for me to be part of it now.
Well, that's nice of you to say. You might know that I usually like to start off by having an author tell us a little bit about their life before they became a published writer, because I think that in some ways can influence the direction they take. So, who was Roger before you became published?
I think it really did influence me, but I've had two careers since college, very closely related careers. The first, I spent a couple decades as a field geologist. And in that time, I stomped all over Idaho and Montana, Oregon, and most of Nevada, working for mining companies, often working alone in pretty remote settings, sometimes days and weeks at a time in the backcountry. And I was paid to climb the hills and walk the ridges and map geology, and mostly to go to these old mining districts, the old mining camps that have been shut down for 100 years, examine the geology there, try to figure out what the old timers were looking at and what they were mining and why the mining ended, try to determine whether or not there was still potential for another company to come in and maybe get a new start on the district. And that's what I did for about 20 years. I met my wife doing that. She was also a geologist, and it didn't take us long to realize that if we both stayed geologists, we weren't going to have much of a family started. So, because she was doing a lot of field work at the time too, so I went back to school and studied engineering, and restarted as an environmental engineer, and I was still working in the mining industry, but I was looking mostly at environmental and groundwater issues related to mining. And instead of keeping me home, that job made me travel even more. I traveled all over the world doing that. I worked on projects, mining projects from northernmost Canada in the wintertime, all the way down through Central and South America. I worked in Asia a little bit, a 2-year project in the Philippines. I did one project in Russia, and I worked a little bit in Australia. So I, you know, the first job, I saw the Northwestern U.S. under my boots very much in detail. And the second job, I saw an awful lot of the world. But in both jobs, I did an awful lot of writing. I was writing technical reports and operating procedures, proposals, and that sort of thing. So that was really the sum total of my writing before I started dabbling in fiction about 12 years ago.
What was your initial path to publication like? Because if I'm understanding correctly, Always Something Sings is not your first book. You've written some other books.
No, as I said, I started writing about 12 years ago, really on a dare from my daughters. I was nagging them about they ought to write because they were so talented, and they turned it around on me one Thanksgiving holiday and say, "Why don't you write?" So I did. I sat down and in the next year and a half put 108,000 ill-advised words together in my first novel. It will never see the light of day. But there were some good parts to it. You know, I went from the beginning of a story through the middle to the end. I had some characters and setting, and I realized at that time that I really could write if I tried. And there was some good writing in it too. Even I could recognize that a few nuggets within it were pretty good writing, and it gave me the confidence to write my second book, which was a book I had hoped to write for over 20 years, and I did write it. It's called The Reclamation. It's up on Amazon right now. I still like it quite a bit. The third book after that, it's called The Magpie's Song, and I think I'll take it down from Amazon because I've had some feedback, and it really doesn't work out very well. It confuses me, and so it's got to confuse the reader too. But those were both self-published, and then with Always Something Sings, I wanted to emphasize a more of a traditional publication, and I took the time. You know, with the the two up on Amazon, I did, in fact, try to find an agent, and I sent out 100 query letters for each of them. And with always something things, I was up to about 50 or 60 query letters and getting discouraged again when Jennifer at Coffeetown Press gave me a call, asked for the full manuscript. And a week later, she called again and said, are you planning to turn this into a series? And how many do you plan to write? And I said, how many do you want? So just for the record, the second one is with Jennifer right now. Oh, and the third, Ada Reed, is complete through first draft. I've outlined the fourth, and I've got a twinkle in my eye about the fifth Ada Reed as well. So I, if I can get a publisher interested in it, I will write it. And I'm loving writing it too. I love the series. I love the setting of the 1950s. I love the characters. So I'm just having a great time with it.
That's wonderful. What can you tell us about Always Something Sings for someone who might be potentially looking at it as their next mystery?
Okay, I'll try to say this short and sweet because I can really ramble on about it. But it is a murder mystery. It's about a young woman, Rose Braden, who is found beaten and drowned in the pond of Goldredge. And you never get to really know Rose Braden because she's found dead on page 5, I think. You only get to know her through other people's eyes and through the evidence that's presented in the book. But she was she ran a roadhouse, and she was more than a bartender. She had a lot of dreams and schemes, and one of those schemes allowed her to discover a hidden potential in this played out old mining district, and that put her at odds with some other people who had other plans for the district. And so the first part of the mystery, and it's true with any murder mystery, is who killed her, how, and why. Now her husband confesses to the murder. He's a soldier just back from the Korean War. He's badly disabled in a wheelchair, but he says he caught her out with her lover and he hit her with a club, knocked her in the water. And the townspeople don't like Rose anyway, so they agree that she was probably out catting around, and the businessmen want the sheriff to wrap things up. But unfortunately for them, and fortunately for my story, the sheriff is utterly incompetent, or at least she's totally inexperienced.
I would say inexperienced. Yeah, she's got
inexperienced.
Yeah.
She's not incompetent. She's inexperienced, and she doesn't have the confidence to close the investigation down. She keeps it going. And even in her inexperience, she can recognize that the victim was not out seeing a lover. She was dressed in an old house dress. She had clunky shoes on her feet. She wore no makeup. That's not how a woman steps out to see a lover. And she can also see that the wounded soldier from his wheelchair probably couldn't have inflicted the wounds that sent the girl into the water. And so the other part of the mystery is, did he do it or did he do it? And if not, why is he confessing to it? And then finally, Rose Braden did have a boyfriend, and he was writing to her, begging her to come to him. She had a packed suitcase, she had money to travel and a ride out of town, and yet she didn't leave. And that's the other thing that Ada Reed, the sheriff, is going to have to solve, is what kept Rose in town one day too long? Why did she end up dead in the dredge pond? So that's the front story. I think the backstory of Always Something Sings is more interesting and a lot funner to write. But that is that's the growth of Ada Reed through the story, from an unassuming 1950s housewife into a strong and confident, a self-aware law officer as the story progresses. And that's the part I really wanted to focus on in the book, is the evolution of Ada Reed.
She's a fascinating character because she didn't set out to become the sheriff. She was just a placeholder until her husband got back from the war.
That's exactly right. They told her that nothing ever happens in Yellow Pine County, and it's I'm trying to remember how I put it. You might see dead drunk ranch hands on weekends or deadbeat husbands once in a while. You might see dead cattle on the highway, but nobody told her anything about a dead girl. And that's what she ends up with on page six. And she's completely unprepared for it. She shows up at the crime scene, and they pull away the tarp, and she reels and has to grab a railing so she doesn't fall down because it's a body. It's slimy, covered with mud. It's broken because it was dredged up with a load of boulders, and she has to work her camera and write copious notes because she doesn't know how else to deal with the situation. She ends up in a beer cooler examining the body in great detail through the day, reaching under the clothes and finding articles that sank the girl in the pond, and turning her pretty face one way and another, and she has to step out from time to time and watch the clouds roll by, or she'll be physically ill. And then at the end of the day, she finally gets the woman wrapped up in a tarp and tied down in the back of the pickup. She makes it a few miles out of town, and she has to step out, hold her hair back, and throw up. And she stumbles forward a couple of feet and sits down in the gravel and cries till the sun goes down. And that's exactly what I would do too in that situation, because Ada Reed is not a superhero. She's a housewife, but she's growing into a new kind of life. And I think that first day changes her forever. She can never go back to her junior league committee meetings or her country club soirees. She's changed by that, and she recognizes that she's different. Her girlfriends aren't comfortable with her
Oh,
anymore,
yeah.
and yet the other law officers don't take her seriously. So she's kind of left in between. She's neither back with her old life or accepted into new life, and she's all by herself. At night, she thinks about the pretty dresses in her closet and wishes she could wear her open-toed heels to Newbury's for lunch with her girlfriends. But she's also recognizes that she's starting on a new path. And I think that's the best part about the book. At least the part that was most important to me is how learning about the victim and the victim's life and the dreams that this Rose Braden had, the disappointments and the dangers she faced, really helps Ada to think about her own life and how she's lived it. And then the interaction with the wounded soldier in the jailhouse interviews, I think, were very important too. He helps her to understand that she's been a victim her whole life too. And so she persists with the investigation, learns to trust herself and her instincts, and she learns to shoot. And that's the first volume of the Ada Reed series.
It is a historical mystery and it is set in the 1950s. What made you decide on that time period?
Well, it's a, you know, it, other than that, it's a very interesting time period in American history. I mean, we were the only superpower on Earth. Suddenly, Americans were safe and prosperous, and they were also absolutely paranoid about nuclear, or they called it atomic war. They were paranoid about flying saucers. I mean, and they were very, I think, in the 50s, a very innocent people coming into their own, but they were also carrying with them a lot of baggage of prejudice from the past. It's a fascinating time in our history. It's really, we were on the verge of a modern era, but not quite over the edge yet. But personally, for me, it's always been really important, the 1950s. It was just before my time, the early 50s, just before my time. And it's the time period of all my family stories. When the family would get together, they'd talk about, some uncle who used to always brawl out at the tavern, or somebody else who went off to war and whatnot. And it always happened in the 50s, and it always happened in central Idaho, incidentally. It's where my father's family grew up. And so just coming back to that time and that place was something I've always done. All of my books are set in central Idaho, and all of my books seem to be set in the mid-century. It's just something that's always drawn me.
How do you get the little details, historical details, right? Like the names of cigarettes. And I think there's a reference to Jockey Box. And it took me a long time to figure out what that was, just from context. Do you find that there's certain sources that you go to? Is a lot of it just accumulated knowledge from your own family's history? How do you balance writing a historical novel that's true to the period with something modern readers can accept?
Well, it is, it is something of a challenge. A lot of it is, I hate to date myself, but a lot of it is accumulated knowledge. But there's a lot of research that goes into it too, and just subtle things. Like at one point, I had in a scene, Ada was thinking of something her husband told her. It's above my pay grade, and it was a perfect phrase for what was going on at the time. But then I looked it up, and it took me quite a while to figure this out. But the first time above my pay grade was used in anything but a literal sense was 1962. And this takes place in 1951. I had to come up with a completely different phrase because the music, I have to look up music, and because I wasn't listening to a lot of music back in the 50s, but Ada Reed listens to certain songs on the radio, and other things like in the 1950s. Most of America had electric ranges or gas ranges. In Idaho, I know for a fact, a lot of the women in the backcountry were still using wood kitchen ranges, wood-fired kitchen ranges. So I have Ada Reed using one of those, at least in the first volume. Maybe she'll get a better stove as the series goes on. But yeah, it's not just accumulated knowledge. You have to do the research, and the internet is great for that sort of thing.
Equally important to the book, I think, is the setting. You really evoke both kind of the grandeur of the Western regions and what it means to the people there. I think at one point you'd written you may have played around a little bit with the geography, but the geology is all true in the setting. Can you talk about setting and why that's so important to the series?
I set this book in the Yankee Fork. My other books were set in central Idaho, but this was in the Yankee Fork, and this is exactly where I worked my first job as a geologist right out of college. I and a few other people I worked with were camped in the Yankee Fork in the old ghost town of Custer, and I walk those ridges. I know the geology quite well. I've been in a lot of the underground mines that I mention in the book, and I've been on the dredge that I mention in the book before it became a tourist attraction. So it was really easy for me to write that part of it. I know the highway to I know every bend of the highway really from the town of Challis to the town of Stanley. I changed the name of Challis to Camas because of something Craig Johnson said in a talk of his that I attended. He invented the Absaroka County, Wyoming, and he admitted that he was given the advice, for God's sakes, don't use the real county name or the real town name. You'll never hear the end of how many mistakes you've made. So I did change the name of that one town. But yeah, it's this is part of the country where my family started. It's important to my childhood in this part of the country, but also just out of college, those very important years where you're making the best friends of your life, and you're drinking beer and fishing and dancing all over the place. It's just one of the best places in the world as far as I'm concerned. So it was very easy to write about it.
Let's talk about your writing process a little bit because you've said that writing is like creating a geological map. What did you mean by that?
I
Yeah.
said that.
I think to me it means that in some ways you have to go about it layer by layer. It's not just you immediately write something down, it's a process.
Well, it really is, and as you're creating a geological map, you have to. I wrote somewhere that the best writing advice was also my best geology advice, and that you have to use both ends of your pencil. You have to have the confidence to use both ends of your pencil. You write you, when you're doing a map, you draw a contact line, and then you have to walk to the other side of the valley and take another look at it, erase it and make it a little bit better, walk over to the other side of the ridge, erase some more and draw it in differently. And that's the only way you can really do a geological map with any confidence, I think. And it's the same thing with writing. There's absolutely no way that you can write, in my opinion, unless you're willing to rewrite and rewrite and rewrite and erase all the time. Because if you're just trying to get the story straight in your mind before you put it on paper, you're not writing, you're daydreaming. Until you start writing and erasing and writing and erasing, you're not writing. And so in that sense, it's very much like geology. But you know, there's another parallel too. The geological work that I did was always solving a mystery. You go into an area and you try to determine what the old timers were doing. Why did they build that stamp mill, or why did they put a road here, or a exploration pit there? And you're solving, you're gathering information, you're coming up with your various conjectures, you develop a theory, you test it, and you solve the mystery. And I've been doing that my entire professional life. And that's probably why I like writing mysteries as much as I do. It's just, again, it's solving things. Very much the same with geology, or the same in geology as it is with writing.
That's great. And it's not to dismiss this, but you also have, there's also kind of a very dry Western sense of humor to your writing in the book. And people may not immediately pick up upon that, but I love the way you describe certain characters like Ethel. I thought she was a real hoot. Is that something that you think is endemic to Western mindset, that kind of dry sense of humor?
Well, I think it is. I don't know if it's more Western than other parts of the country. Maybe we bring it out differently. I do like Ethel as well, and she continues to be an important part in further volumes of the Ada Reed series. But yeah, she calls, what does she refer to Ada Reed as? Fancy badge. And sheriff lady. I think she's a very real person. It just reminds me of some of the women that I've known in my life. Actually, she very much reminds me of my oldest sister, who is something of a second mother for me, but very much in that way. And there is a dry sense of humor about her. I don't know. I don't want to get into it too much. It might get me in trouble. She doesn't necessarily respect authority as much as she ought to.
No, and in some ways it rang true to me, because if you understand, if you know anything about Western United States history, women have always been at the forefront of demanding equality. I mean, we were the first states to give women the right to vote. Women held public office.
Nothing against
women on the East Coast, but it's just, it seemed like it happened earlier here.
Well, I think it did. And that's because women, without women, the West probably would never have been settled completely. Yeah. Because it was a very hard life. But who was it? Jeanette Rankin Montana?
Montana.
Montana. And Wyoming was the first state to give women the vote, I believe.
It was.
So, yeah, you're right.
The equality state, yeah.
It is. And I don't know, maybe that's why I allowed Ada Reed to be the first sheriff, female sheriff of Yellow Pine County. Mm-hmm. But it was very important to me that she was, and also very important to me that she succeeded at it, because she reminds me so much of, again, of the women that I've grown up with my whole life. Mm-hmm. And I just have a lot of faith in them. I just know that they're normal, everyday people, and there's just an awful lot of strength in that, and I wanted to make that come out with Ada Reed, that she's just an ordinary person, and you don't want to doubt her.
Yeah,
she's gonna stand up and do her job. So.
Let's shift direction a little bit and talk about your life as a reader. Did you always read mysteries? Is that why you're writing mysteries? Are there certain authors that you kind of think helped shape your path as a writer? What does your reading life look like?
Well, The first important thing to understand is I'm a very slow reader and have been my whole life. I've got some kind of mechanical thing with my eyes. They don't work as a team as they should as I skim across the line. So where my wife right now can easily read 100 books a year, I'll be lucky to finish 10 or 15 books a year. And that it's been that way my whole life. I haven't always read mysteries. In fact, I used to really enjoy historical novels, big sweeping historical novels that I could really sink into and get away from the world and just live it for. And the thing is, if I've got a 600 page novel, I'm going to be with that thing for a month, you know, and really living it day to day. Even when I'm not reading it, I'm still living the scenes and with the characters and coming up with different aspects of the story that even the author may not have thought about. So I read slowly. I think I read thoroughly and sometimes way too thoroughly these books. But I've gotten into mysteries recently and used to enjoy them a lot. And I hate to say this, but when I'm reading a mystery now, I'm looking at how that author put together the story, how she's laid out the breadcrumbs for the reader to follow, and I'm watching the writer's craft more than I'm sinking into the book, and so I'm really not enjoying them as much as I used to, and for that reason I'm reading more nonfiction now than I used to. But I wonder if you've heard that from other authors that you've interviewed, that once they started writing, they're just not enjoying the reading as much as they used to.
I think many, I wouldn't say all, but many authors tend to fall into your camp too. They lose some of the enjoyment as a reader because they're looking at the book technically to see how it works, what they would have done. I think some authors, a few, hesitate to read in their own genre just because they don't want to feel unduly influenced or somehow pick up something through osmosis that was not there. Yeah. So I guess that's the trade-off. If you want to be a writer, you lose some of the joy you get in just being a reader.
I've certainly experienced that, and I'm really sorry about it too. But in answer to your question, the authors that I do like, the mystery writers I do like, are like Nevada Barr with her Anna Pigeon series.
Yeah.
Anne Cleese, of course. Oh. Though she's more of a professional detective rather than an amateur sleuth. I like C.J. Box and just Joe Pickett. Now Craig Johnson, I think maybe Longmire was a little bit too macho. I don't think I could take too much of Longmire and you know, put it into an A to read book. It wouldn't work out very well. But right now I'm reading, of all things, I'm reading a lot of Pat Conroy, because I'm talking to you from Dufusky Island off the coast of South Carolina. And that's, if you remember, that's the island where Pat Conroy came to teach when he was a young man. And he wrote, I just read his memoir, The Water is Wide. I had never read it. It's it was very interesting being here and seeing the geographical places that he talked about. I'm reading his Great Santini now. And as slow as I read, that'll take me a couple of weeks to finish. But I'm really enjoying it. See, it's not a mystery, and I'm not really analyzing it like I would a mystery. And I'm having a great time with it.
That's great. My own guess is that what you're reading and what you have read, there's also that strong sense of place, and that may draw you in as a reader. You find books that give you that geographic setting or that sense of being there.
Yeah, I've always, I used to love Wallace Stegner for his settings, and because he wrote of places where I lived, and it was a lot of fun. Yeah.
You did mention that this is the first in a new series. Can you tell us anything about what's coming next, or is that something that we have to leave a mystery for now?
No, I mentioned that the second volume is in copy edit right now, so it's doing well. It's called Lightning Caused, and in that book, Ada across a whole family that seemed to have sat down and let a forest fire overtake them. They weren't drunk, and the forensics show that they weren't dead before the fire came through. The car was gassed up, and yet they didn't try to avoid this fire. And she has to investigate that and a couple other deaths along the way as well, and try to figure out what's going on. And it's going to be a really nice mystery, I think, with a lot of forensic twists in it. It involves historically, it involves one of the suspects is Japanese, and he happened to have been an inmate at a Japanese internment camp, which there was in southern Idaho at the time. And one of the dead people was a guard at the camp. And so there's that intrigue along with the story as well. The third A to read that's already complete to first draft, and there'll be a second, third, and fourth draft, but it's the story is all there. It is more of an inward-looking mystery here. A to read dredges up because of the drought, lowers the water level in a reservoir. They find an old car at the bottom of the reservoir. They dredge it up, and there are a couple skeletal remains inside. And they happen to be classmates of Ada's back in high school. And the story is about how they died, and it involves a lot of Ada and her friends going back and trying to understand who they were when they were young and why they weren't able to help these young people who died. And it talks a lot about personal disappointments in life. And in that book, she's going to have a lot of marital problems too, which comes out in the first book and are accentuated in the second book, and they come to a head in the third book. So it's more of an inward looking story. And then the fourth A to read, well, it's only an outline, but it's going to be a wet and wild chase with bad guys down the middle fork of the Yankee River, the river of no return. So we'll have to see if Ada returns from that.
Well, it's great that there's things in the future for fans of your first book. How can readers learn more about your books? Are you on social media? Is there a website?
There is a website. It's rogerhowellbooks.com. I need to get in there and maybe clean it up and get it up to date. I'm on Facebook, but not on an author's page, and I have to fix that. Right now, though, John, I'm without a home. You're seeing me come from Defusky Island because we sold our house 3 or 4 months ago, and we thought we'd buy another house in Colorado, but nobody is selling. And we've just been traveling around. We spent a month in North Carolina. In Maine. I'm a month on Defusky Island now, and we have no idea where we're going from here.
That makes it challenging.
It is challenging. I'd love to start getting my social media caught up, get a better Facebook page that's more professional, but I just haven't had a chance recently, so I'll have to get on that as quickly as I can.
Well, that's something to do, but more importantly is to continue to write such wonderfully entertaining books. I can't believe how quickly our time has just flown by. We've been very fortunate at the Poison Pen to have with us Roger Lynn Howell, whose new book is Always Something Sings, a remarkable first start to launch to a series. I'd like to thank Roger for taking time to be with us and sharing his thoughts.
It was a lot of fun. I really appreciate being here. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank all of you listening in to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.